Before we begin today's show, I have some important news to share with you. Premier Insight's financial year ends on June the 30th, and it's vital we close a final funding gap of $94,000 by that date. The great news is generous friends of the ministry have offered a new $5,000 matching grant, which will double your gift today up to that amount. That's why I wanted to take just a moment before we get into today's podcast to ask for your help. If you would, please take a moment today to give your best gift at premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you for understanding how important your gift is today and for giving generously. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim White and I'm pleased to be joined by, as always, my dad, John White. How are you, Dad?
Hi, Tim.
And we're really pleased to say we've got a guest on the show today. That's Natalie Collins. Hi, Natalie.
Hello.
Really pleased to have you on the show. For those who haven't come across you and your work before, would you mind giving a kind of brief elevator style pitch? Who are you? What do you do?
Yeah, I feel like you'd need like a really tall building to do the elevator pitch because I do quite a lot of different things and they're a bit like, so people may have come across some of the things I've done and not realise that I'm the same person who does all this stuff. In kind of my paid work, I run a charity called the Women's Liberation Collective, and what we do is we have a course called the Own My Life course that I wrote in, we launched it in 2019, and it works. We train practitioners across the UK and Ireland to deliver that course with women in contexts where women have been subject to abuse. We've trained over 1,000 practitioners. It's run with over 10,000 women so far. So that's kind of my like paid proper job. I've done a lot of work over the last 15 years around men's violence towards women, predominantly, well, about 50% of it's been within a Christian context. So I helped to set up an organization and was involved in the early stage of an organization called Restored, which came out of Tear Fund to respond to men's violence against women. I wrote a course for young people about abuse and exploitation, and we train practitioners across the UK to run that, but that's outside of a Christian context. I've done a lot of, I suppose, a bit of rabble rousing and being a critical friend. I'm not sure that people would count me as a friend, but I feel like I'm really friendly deep down. And I set up a Twitter account and blog called God Loves Women, where I've done quite a lot of encouraging the church to be better. And that in the last year, I accidentally ended up doing a lot of advocacy and challenge around the situation that came out of Soul Survivor, a UK-based ministry and church, and the work the kind of leader there, Mike Pulavachi, has emerged, was perpetrating all sorts of stuff. And I also have a book called Out of Control, Couples, Conflict and the Capacity for Change, which is primarily about how to help the people who support those who've been subject to abuse. So friends, family, church leaders. It's written with kind of a Christian audience in mind, but is written in a way that's accessible to those who have no faith or another faith. So lots of different things, but that's a brief. We're on about, like, you know, kind of floor 35.
That's brilliant. Thank you so much. There's so many big questions we want to dive into with your work and the questions around abuse in the church. But this whole kind of line of work you came out of a quite personal, your own experience, didn't it? Would you mind sharing a bit about that? Because I know there was a big news story here in the UK in the Sunday Times earlier this year, which kind of really exposed lots of stuff I didn't know about your own background. So would you mind sharing as much of that as you're comfortable?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that I've worked in a kind of expertise that I've got. I'm a national expert on issues around men's violence towards women. And I think I've always been very willing to share my story within that. But what I found is over the years that if you kind of do work in the media and you're invited on to, you know, like the big question I've done before and radio and stuff, what I found was very often if I came on as a story, they then bring in an expert in to like translate my experience. And I was like, no, I am the expert, but I also have this story. And I think the kind of othering of those with stories, like, I mean, the term that's creeping in is the term lived experience, which I literally want to throw something at, because do you know a form of experience that's not lived? Because I don't. And so this kind of like, what we have is these like waves of how we're going to try to honor and respect and value those with their own stories. But we end up doing it in a way that fundamentally others them as not essentially having an expertise. And so that's why often people aren't very aware of my story, because over the years, what I've wanted to do is step away from this kind of the way that I become othered and my expertise as a specialist becomes diminished. So my background and story really is I grew up in an evangelical Christian home in the north of England, a working class family. And so I'd learned a couple of things about relationships. They should be with someone of the opposite sex who professes the same faith. And it doesn't matter whether they're a nice person, whether you really like them very much, as long as they're washed in the blood, that's it, really. And then the second thing was that sex is like a chocolate cake. You put it in the fridge and you stay out of the kitchen. And so at 17, when I met a boy who actually was really beautiful, he was 17 and I was, he had recently become a Christian through the United Beach missions. I don't know if they're still going on, but through that, he'd like had this evangelistic experience, became a Christian. So I was like, oh, ticks the boxes. So I start this relationship with him, and it emerged actually that he was very dangerous. He manipulated me into sexual activity very quickly. And I think that teaching around kind of sex being like a chocolate cake that you keep in the fridge, it doesn't really give a distinction between the choice to go in the fridge and eat all that chocolate cake, or the reality of being dragged in the fridge and being force-fed chocolate cake. And so that sense of actually a lot of our kind of Christian messaging around sex and around consent is, well, there isn't really much around consent, is there? And so so that meant then when he'd manipulated me into sex, I was then like, well, I've got to marry him. That's the only way to stop Jesus being sad. And so I then was like 12 days into a relationship with someone I didn't really know, thinking, this is it. I just have to be with this person forever. And that then led into me being with him for 4.5 years. It emerged that he was very dangerous. He was very sexually violent, very emotionally abusive. I became pregnant within 6 months because he wouldn't use contraception. And so I escaped when I was 21, and I was 6 months pregnant with my son. This is my second child, and he raped me, and my son was born 3 months premature. So we ended up living in a hospital for about 5 months with my daughter, who was 2.5. And it was that those circumstances that forced me to have to leave him. I didn't become sort of strong and empowered to be like, right, now that's it, I'm getting out. It was purely circumstances. And that situation is obviously, for anybody, will be a defining reality for their life. And I think for me, it was living in a hospital with this premature baby who was very sick, who was on ventilators, who kept on getting very, very poorly. And I mean, I'm 40 now. Well, I'm 40 this year, but I still don't look very old. And so when I was 21, I looked about 14, and I was like with these two kids. And you know, for me, that experience, everything was stripped away. Everything that I thought he understood about my life, about God, about the world, about everything. And I met God in a really profound way when I was living in a hospital. And God really said to me, you need to stop praying for Joshua to live, and you need to pray for my will to be done. And actually that sense of even giving up the hope that God was going to like give me my baby, like was going to be okay, was actually a really liberating and transformational space for me in terms of what it invited me to understand about who God is. It's a bit like that place in Job, you know, like where Job's like wanting God to explain, and God's like, were you there when I made everything? And you're just like, I'm so unkind and so rude. But actually what it did is this sense of defining who God was and who I was, like a creature in the creator, was actually huge transformation. And my children are now 21 and 18. And so through that experience, I started to recognize that what had been done to me was abuse. I didn't know that. I started to go through lots of processes to understand the abuse I'd been subject to understand the theology that I'd like inherited that was really harmful, and came out the other side. And then the reason why this story was in the Sunday Times is that fast forward 20 years from that time, and my ex-husband has been convicted of a number of counts of raping lots of three different women, and actually has been serially raping women for 20 years in ways that have been, the whole system has failed women and girls, because he was convicted of sex offences against teenage girls while I was in a relationship with him. And so, yeah, so it's quite a complicated story, but people can Google Natalie Collins Sunday Times and the article comes up, or my book, actually, although the book is about how to help people, my story is woven through it as well.
Well, thank you so much for sharing all of that. Really, a quite difficult story to listen to in many ways. Were you part of the church at the time? How did the Christians around you deal with, support with, or not support you as you were going through this?
Yeah, I mean, it's complicated because I wouldn't have even articulated what was being done to me as abuse. So the idea that anybody else would have understood that was complicated. And so one of the biggest challenges we have in responding to abuse is that it's often misdiagnosed by everybody, not just by Christians, but by, you know, in lots of contexts. We have this idea of what somebody is subjected to abuse looks like. And that's where the othering of those who are abused is so harmful, because we get, oh, well, she's strong and capable, she can't be being abused. Oh, he's a lovely man, he's not like that. And so there's a whole kind of challenge around that. So because my ex-husband was convicted of sex offences when we were both 19, the church then did have, it was at the beginning of safeguarding, like, in the church. So this was 2004. So, you know, like, taking it as a thing that should be done, but nobody really knew what to do. So when he was convicted of abusing a teenage girl, that did then lead to them saying he couldn't go to any activities that were with people under 18 in the church. And he wasn't an active member of the church, but had come to some stuff along with me. And so there wasn't really, but there wasn't really any recognition that I might be being harmed by him. Like, that wasn't just him, that was the probation service, the police. Nobody identified that. The reality is that sex offenders are generally abusing their partner. If a partner stays with somebody after they've perpetrated sex offences and been found guilty, generally, like, that would be my baseline assumption, is that he's abusive and manipulative towards her as well. It was just really challenging. I think nobody really knew what to do when my son was born. Like, people didn't even just the. I mean, and this will be more in line with the stuff that you kind of worked on, John. That nobody even knew whether to send a card because my kid was premature. Do you know, like, do we celebrate this birth? There was lots of other factors around being the parent of a premature baby, like stuff around being a very young being. I was pregnant at 17. Like, actually, like, should we? You know, this sense that my family felt they had to, like, support me into marrying him because that was what Jesus would want, even though, like, clearly there was stuff that was not okay. And so I think for me, there's kind of an underpinning theology that doesn't really work in practice when you're dealing with somebody, a perpetrator in the mix, and actually often doesn't work in practice regardless. And then there's a kind of cultural notions and cultural norms which are informed by theology but are actually separate to them. And then you've got the wider culture, you know, where actually it wasn't just messages I'd had from the church. I grew up with things like 10 Things I Hate About You and Cruel Intentions as the films, which were all about the love of a good woman saves a bad boy. And when you then combine that with, like, Jesus can save this person from their sin, like, when my ex-husband a few weeks into the relationship was like, I am going to hurt you, like, I am a bad person, I will hurt you. And I was like, this is the first step to changing. Me and Jesus can love him into transformation. And so I think that there's a lot around, and, you know, we were the kind of history maker generation, you know, like, that sense that actually we were gonna be able to change the world back through Jesus, and that having implications for the role we felt we had, that I think potentially younger people now have a different narrative, the Gen Z have.
Yeah, so I mean, there's so many interesting lines here, but isn't it? So one of them is just this basic understanding that coercion control, and particularly male coercion control over women, is a real thing, and that it's much more common than we used to think. And I mean, we're all on a journey about this, aren't we? But it does feel, if you just take secular society as a whole, it feels that this is an idea whose time has arrived. It's taken a long time getting there, but I think if you ask people generally, you know, do you think that some men are just terrible in the way they treat women and that they manipulate and coerce them, you know, I think most people say, yeah, I mean, you're not really telling us anything new. We know this now. It's taken us a long time to recognize it. It's interesting, isn't it, that it seems like the church is, for all kinds of complicated reasons, it's kind of further back in recognizing the reality of this. I mean, is that what you see?
Yeah, well, I think one of the things is the church, one of the challenges we have as a church is that we have a lot of messages for the sinner, but not a lot for the sinned against, even though fundamentally, like, the reason why God hates sin is because of the harm that it causes. But, like, our whole kind of structure of our theology focuses on us all as sinners. Like, the fact that by virtue of being sinners, there must be people we're harming in our sinfulness becomes secondary, because it's all our vertical relationship between us and God becomes the center and focus, which means our ability to do the kind of horizontal relationship between one another becomes really tricky. And so that the redemption narrative also means that we're often very compelled by our responsibility to the perpetrator, actually. Like, that very often if it comes to, like, that someone's a perpetrator, the response that you will get in the church is, well, how do we support this person towards redemption? And in some ways, like, the secular kind of notion that we should just cancel people and that should be the end of them, and they should basically just go die in a hole and never be allowed to do anything again, it's not necessarily like either or. But I do think that sense of you know, like, we saw, for instance, the Baptist church that were behind the baptizing of the guy who turned out to be a sex offender and their acid attack, you know, all of that stuff. Actually, like, the conversation on the left and right for that situation, that woman and her children, gets lost in that, because it's either can he be redeemed or should he not have been, offered a space? And it's like, actually, like, it shouldn't be either or. It should be what safeguards need to exist in churches to ensure that we protect the most vulnerable.
Yeah, that's really interesting, isn't it? Because, of course, historically, and if you go back to the Old Testament, then that was the big deal, that God was on the side of the widows and the orphans and the oppressed and the defenseless, and that God's people had to be on their side too. So that idea that Christianity is focused on protecting and defending the vulnerable, that's very deeply rooted, isn't it? But as you say, isn't it, once you've got this idea of redemption, and it's something we've talked about in previous episodes, and it's a very rich and wonderful Christian idea, but it's so easy then that in this context, everyone, as you say, then thinks about the perpetrator, and we've somehow lost this primary commitment to protecting the vulnerable.
Yeah, and I think, like you say, that lots of people would say, oh yeah, there are men who treat women badly, but there aren't any of them in our church. Fundamentally, there are some men who treat women badly, but I wouldn't know any of those men, yeah. And I wouldn't know any of those women. And I think some of that's about us wanting church to be a family that's a safe place. And actually, if we start to acknowledge that the same harms that exist everywhere exist in the church, like, it's what, which is biblical and theologically accurate, it undermines our ability to feel like the definition of our community comes from this sense that we are a redeemed people seeking to live differently. And, you know, for instance, what one of the things that's been so kind of faith shattering or challenging about the Mike Plavacci situation is that that there's something about our belief in our relationship with God that gives us a capacity to discern and have wisdom, that in relationship with the Holy Spirit, we become people who are more like discerning of, and, you know, that God guides us to see right and wrong. And also, I think there's definitely a sense, which I don't think is theologically accurate, that where the numbers are, that's where God is more. Do you know, like, that if there's, you know, this sense that, well, if there's 20,000 young people and it's under a tent, then God must be there more than where there's, like, you know, three in a church or something. So there's something about that the threat that comes if in a church, you know, whether it is a guy who's kind of upheld by lots of leaders, but actually it happens, the same sort of thing is happening in a church where you have everybody has trusted this guy, thought this guy's a nice guy. He might be the church leader, he might be the worship leader, he might just be a regular member of the congregation. And actually, when it emerges that his behaviour is, he's been perpetrating some form of abuse to his partner, when she comes to us and she says, and she won't come to us and tell us the worst thing that he's done, what she'll do is she'll gently start to say, oh, you know, my, like, oh, my husband, you know, is there any way that we could get some help with our finances? Because my husband's not really giving me enough money to be able to, or whatever. Or actually, my husband said it's probably best if I stop working. Or, you know, there's some sort of thing. It'll just be a gradual, gentle, what are people, how are going to people respond to this very, very, like, tiny amount of the information? And there are two options that we are faced with as the person receiving that information. We can believe her. But in believing her, we have to do a lot of unpicking about how we come to decisions about who is safe and who is not safe. Because we decided her husband was safe. We like him. He's a lovely guy. And suddenly, when she's telling us that he isn't, we have two choices. Do I believe her, which requires me to do a lot of unpicking about my understanding of who is safe and who is not, or I can think she's potentially a bit misunderstood. I'm not saying she's not telling the truth, but actually I can keep my beliefs and I can remain comfortable in my sense of being able to be clear about who is safe and who is not safe. And the way that I will do that is I will talk to her about how maybe she might be misunderstood, and I'm sure that he didn't mean it. And has he got anything difficult going on at the minute that might be causing him to feel like that? And do you think we could maybe get him some counselling? Because it sounds like, you know, I know he's a good guy, so clearly it can't be that he's intentionally, deliberately controlling or harming his family. Like, that can't happen. And so, but, and that's all happening in a split second. That person is not, they're not thinking, I've got to make a decision about whether I'm willing to change my whole worldview about how I decide who is safe and who is not safe. Because this isn't just about this woman. This is about the people I find that are safe to be around my kids, the people I allow to babysit them, the people that I trust as my friends. And so, like, there's a whole world-shattering nature that is required when somebody discloses to us in the context of a faith community or a family or other things. And so what happens is, rather than doing that work, which is highly threatening and highly uncomfortable, we immediately go into the, and the Christian culture around redemption and forgiveness and being kind and caring, and also middle class notions of, like, politeness as well. All of these, this kind of, all this stuff comes in that means that that woman is not met by belief and trust, and how can we take seriously what she's saying and create a space where she can be honest about actually how severe this is. Instead, we go into the, oh, well, it can't, we minimize and we diminish it in order to keep ourselves in the place where we're comfortable. And that's what's really going on. So it's really hard to deal with that, because what you've got to do is people have got to be willing to sit in a place of discomfort. And if one thing the church has not done very well recently, it's creating spaces of discomfort, really.
That's so helpful, Natalie. It's really, really powerful way of talking about it. And I think, you know, we've talked already about the really common theme in churches of people struggling to take seriously what they're hearing from women in the congregations about abuse. But I guess the flip side is, when you do go on that kind of earth-shattering journey, and I'm probably speaking for myself, I've been on that, just observing, not personally, but reporting on the church over many years, I'm now kind of numb to how many church leaders are exposed, who I'd thought from a distance were great, who are exposed as abusers. I've come to a place where I'm actually not surprised about anyone. I don't really trust anyone. There's people who I have absolutely no evidence or no reason to believe that they might be harmful. But if you told me tomorrow that they are, I would accept it in a heartbeat. And we sometimes talk about this under the language of the hermeneutic of suspicion, that we live in a kind of suspicious culture which doesn't want to trust or believe in anyone anymore. Is that your framework now? Or do you think that's equally dangerous as the kind of other end of the spectrum?
Well, I wouldn't say that that's a hermeneutic of suspicion. I would be keen on exploring hermeneutics of suspicion. And I think that we have a lot to, we owe a lot to the theologians who've done that work. But I would say it's a fundamental principle that everybody is a sinner. Like, that is a theologically, like, really, really baseline assumption. So why are we as Christians surprised that those people, that some people sin in ways that are sexually violent and some people sin in ways that are harmful, very, very harmful? I think The problem we have is that we assume that those who are given status and power, particularly if we're going to go into talking more about leadership and leaders who have made active choices to be harmful, I can't stand it when people talk passively about leaders falling, you know, like it's a hole that they just like slipped into by accident. You know, they make active choices over a lot of years to compromise repeatedly, not just fell at the end of it. This is years and years. Mike Polovacci did not just start massaging men naked on his bed or semi-naked on his bed. You know, he started by being given a free pass when there were minor infringements of the ethics and integrity that we should all be holding ourselves to as Christians. And not only did he do that, he was colluded with and facilitated to do those things by the people around him who should have been holding him to account, because the fruit of his ministry meant that people were happy to compromise the integrity of the message and the integrity that each of us should be held to, because the results were more important. And so, like, you know, like fundamentally, but anyway, in terms of the reason why people find the whole kind of leadership stuff around people in leadership falling is that we presume that those in leadership are operating at a higher standard. But that is an assumption that can only work if you have a culture and community that is holding a theology which requires that standard to be maintained. And I don't think it does, because I think what we measure success by is this person living a life of full obedience and integrity to God. We make a decision about that person's based on them holding particular charismatic giftings, based on whether they're how many numbers of people they are attracting to them, how successful they are in being attractional about the gospel. And so I think in that context, why would we expect our leaders to behave with integrity? Because the whole system of leadership in kind of contemporary Christianity is colluding with and essentially grooming people into forms of discipleship as leaders, which is really quite like actually incompatible with being a disciple of Jesus, which is a much bigger problem. And that's why we shouldn't be surprised that this is not just about lots of leaders make choices to do terrible things. This is about a culture which promotes people into leadership who hold a particular set of competencies and don't necessarily have the character that goes along with that and aren't being required to.
Yeah, I mean, it is something we've talked about before, but I mean, it's very, very troubling, isn't it? That it's almost like the contemporary informal church culture, particularly in the evangelical and charismatic and nonconformist end of the spectrum, it's almost like you're setting it up for coercion control. You use that phrase, it's grooming people, which is kind of shocking. But I can see the force of it. It almost seems because it's all about, as you say, finding people who are quote anointed, who have obvious gifting, who've got a track record of quote success, putting them into powerful positions, allowing them to exercise soft power to take on this status of the anointed leader. And then, of course, they've got to, in order to achieve their goals, they've got all these wretched volunteers who are not being paid, but who are absolutely essential for me achieving my success, achieving my goals. So the only way I've do is somehow I've got to envision them, I've got to persuade them, I've got to encourage them, rebuke them. But it's almost like, yeah. Now what we know, given about the risks, particularly for certain men and their sinful natures, you're setting it up for a disaster. I mean, if you were starting again with a clean sheet of paper, what would you say, you know, what would be a better way to do it?
Do you mean we'd like need to ask God to like go back on the whole flood thing and be like, just...
start again. It was a great mistake. Yeah, reminds me of the graffiti I remember, you know, where it said, you know, is God dead? And then someone has scribbled, no, merely engaged on a less ambitious research project.
I think what I would say is I don't think we can go back to a blank page, because that's not a reality. But one of the things that I'd say is that we have, one of the big issues we have is that we have created a model of Christianity which is full of uncritical consumers of of Christian culture. So actually, the model is that you go to the event, you buy the book, you listen to the thing, and actually we're not cultivating forms of discipleship which give people a deep and meaningful relationship with God, mediated by Jesus, empowered by the Holy Spirit, that is not actually being kind of predominantly influenced by this requirement that essentially the people in evangelical Christianity, I think, but I would say probably across every theological persuasion, I think liberal Christianity has its own challenges in terms of accept. I wouldn't consider myself a liberal at all. If anything, I want to be a radical, but I'm certainly, I think people would make lots of assumptions about my theology, but I'm certainly not very liberal. But what I would say is that this kind of sense that we're all uncritically consuming whichever we feel most, the theology we feel most comfortable with. And so this sense that if somebody, and actually the whole of the culture is predicated on perpetuating that, you know, if you don't sell out Spring Harvest and New Wine, and if you don't, you know, keep these, selling these, you know, the Christian industrial complex is enormous, you know, and it is part of a broader consumer culture, isn't it? Do you know what I mean? Like, I feel like it's just like burn it all. No, don't burn it all down. But I think, well, no, do that's it. But I think, so I suppose for me, that's the thing, that you are creating a model of what it is to be a Christian that essentially means uncritically accepting whatever you're told. And as long as the person has lots of support from people that they believe that the only people who are considered to supposed to have any sort of critical engagement are the leaders. And those leaders are invested in perpetuating the uncritical consumers of the, you know. So I think that's if we want to change this, it starts by us going back to the Bible, and a sense that this is about learning to be obedient to God, to build a relationship with God that is not fundamentally mediated by people who are selling books and who are, as I say, this is someone who's written a book, but as people who are selling books or people who are, you know, selling tickets to events. And essentially, I feel like that's really hard in a wider culture that is in late stage capitalism, that is in it, that actually, how do you model a non-consumeristic Christianity in a culture that is entirely consumeristic? And I don't know really what, yeah. I don't have any practical solutions, but I can tell you definitely some of the problems.
You hear that, Dad? No more conference speaking. Cancel the book public deal, publishing deal. Burn it all to the ground.
Actually, Tim, I now know what you are. You're part of the Christian industrial complex. That's what you are, mate.
Outrageous. I'm speaking truth to power.
I just wanted to quickly remind you that Premier Insight has been offered a new $5,000 matching grant that will double your gift today up to that amount. And right now, that's an incredible blessing, as there is a final funding gap of $94,000 that must be closed before the end of our financial year on June the 30th. This show depends fully on the generosity of friends like you. So I'm asking you to please give your very best gift right now to close this gap, knowing your gift will be doubled. You can give now at premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
I wanted to come back to, we talked quite early when we were talking in the context of kind of personal relationships and abuse and violence, not from church leaders, but within congregations. You know, I suspect listening to this, there will be some Christian men who are saying, look, Natalie, I'm all on board with, we don't want abuse, we want to speak it out, but is hashtag not all men, is this a bit, why are you making it all about male violence against women? Aren't some men also victims? I'm a good feminist. I'm not part of the problem. Why do we have to make this so gendered? Can't we just talk about violence and abuse unattached to whatever gender is perpetrating it? What was your response to that?
Well, usually my first response if somebody says, what about the men, is I'd love to know what they're doing to help men, because I would love to be great to know how they're actively helping men and supporting them. Because very often they're not actually doing anything. They just want me to do things. Well, I'm already doing lots of things, so I'd love for them to do some things to help men. I think men can do a load of things to help other men and aren't really doing that very often. They're just waiting for women to do it, which is often what women are expected for, all the unpaid and low paid and poor power, poor status work, while the men tell us how we should do it. So that's not I'm saying you're doing that. I appreciate that too. But I think, so it's really interesting that the Evan Stark, who wrote the book Coercive Control, who is probably like he didn't create the concept coercive control. That was mainly women. But he's a person who everybody heard of. That's interesting, isn't it? Anyway, and what's really interesting is I'm reading his book at the moment, and he makes it very clear that coercive control in the way that it is constructed can only exist in a context that is patriarchal and is perpetrated by men towards women. So his definition of coercive control is gendered. So that's a really interesting thing. And actually what's happened as this concept has been taken on by governments and by policymakers, it has been degendered because it's very difficult to make gendered policy. And so he actually talks about how the fact that coercive control as a concept has only really existed since women have had more legal rights. So in countries where women don't have any status or rights, generally men do not control women in the same way they do in countries where women do have rights and legal status, because they don't have to, because women do as they're told, because they don't have any choice. So actually the reason coercive control develops is in generally democratic nations where women have been given the vote and essentially are operating as equal citizens under law, because then what individual men have to do is create essentially a mini patriarchal home life that allows them to keep women controlled and within the role they demand of them. And where women are given, where countries have that role for women or communities have that role, so fundamentalist Christian communities, for instance, in America, you would generally find that there won't be as much coercive control because the women won't resist, because essentially they're not allowed to. Or, you know, you would find that in countries that are under Sharia law, or, you know, that essentially where you, that what coercive control does is it requires its perpetrators are requiring their partner to operate in a liberal democratic framework where women have rights without denying them the access to those rights. So the understanding that is fundamental to understanding what coercive control is, how it develops, and why domestic abuse is actually a high rate in countries where there is a lot of equality for women. Because one of the arguments people have is, well, why is there not less domestic violence in the UK than in this area? And it's because essentially the forms of domestic violence increase because the men who want the benefits of systems which allow them to get what they want can't do that in line with legal frameworks. So they have to kind of develop informal frameworks to allow them to do that. So I think it's really important that we understand this kind of broader picture. And that's why we have to have a gendered analysis of this. And that's not to say that women can't be awful. I've met some awful women. I'm sure you know some awful women. You know, it's not that women can't perpetrate abuse. It's just that abuse does not exist in a context in which women owned men like 150, 200 years ago in this country. Like, so the way that operates is very different. Also, the standards we hold women to means that women who perpetrate forms of abuse, that it will be at a lower level and will be judged much more harshly than a man doing those things because of the gendered roles and the gendered norms in our society. So fundamentally, we have to treat people in the particularity of their reality, because it actually doesn't do men any good to be supported in the way that women need supporting with coercive control. That men need different things. Men generally don't want support groups. They want practical support with housing, for instance. And so trying to squash everyone into what women need who are being subject to coercive control is actually really detrimental to both men and women. It's why actually it's really tricky for women's services to provide support to trans people, because actually the needs trans people have are often quite different, and the forms of perpetration they've been subject to are very often different to the forms of perpetration in other contexts. And so understanding this stuff is actually really crucial to ensuring that everybody gets the right support they need. And what's one of the really interesting stats, and this like is horrifying, is that the development of refuges in America actually saved more men's lives than women's, because women suddenly had an option to escape their abusive partner, which didn't mean killing him. And so for every one woman saved by a refuge in America, 3.5 men have been saved. Because these violent men who were controlling and like holding their partners hostage, the only way she could have previously escaped was to kill him. And then a refuge gave her another option. And so for those people who were like, why should we be helping men, women? Because it will save men's lives. Fundamentally.
Wow. I had no idea. That's really eye-opening, isn't it? Yeah. And I guess you can't get away from the fact that as much as it, you know, deeply sorrows me, that's not a word, is it? It makes me feel sorrow. Is that, you know, you look at the rates of convictions of domestic violence, which, as you say, is in the UK law is a kind of non-gendered crime. You know, women can be charged with this crime as much as men can. And I mean, you'll know the numbers better than I am, but I imagine it's in the high 90% of those perpetrators who are convicted who are men. And that's equally true in all other forms of
92%.
There you go. So
crime of men.
It is. It is hard to get away from the fact that this is a sin, or at least in the way that the law is capturing it, is a sin which is vastly perpetrated by men, vastly out of proportion with our, you know, 50-50 numbers in society. And it seems foolish to me to ignore that kind of gendered element to it in a kind of misguided attempt to be equal when it's not equal, is it? It's not an equal crime. It's not an equal, the victims aren't equal.
And that's also fascinating. I hadn't really connected that before, Natalie, about the fact that how domestic violence is a problem where democracy is giving women rights and status and education and all the rest. And I mean, I'm sure, of course, there is domestic violence in these traditional patriarchal...
Well, there's lots of violence, but there's not coercive control. So right. The men will be very violent to women, kill women, like subject them to very extreme violence, but these kind of much more subtle coercive controlling exactly. behaviours aren't required.
Yeah. And so, you know, thinking men to men, it does seem to me that one of the key issues behind all this is the concept of respect, that fundamentally, once I, as a man... or as anybody, regard this other being, this person, as a tool, as a means for me to achieve my ulterior motives, whatever they are, you know, whether it's, you know, to have my needs met at home, or whether it's to lead my church and achieve my goals. As soon as I have perceived this other person, and particularly this other woman, as a means to my ends, then something horrible is about to happen. There's something bad, and so the essence of trying to teach men is this understanding of respect, of treating this other person, even though she seems to be getting in my way and causing me difficulty and all the rest, that I cannot treat her as just a means to my end. I must respect her as a precious individual in her own right.
Yeah, and fundamentally abusers view their partner as something they own and something they're entitled to get what they want from. So ownership and entitlement are core parts of abusive behaviour, which again is why it's the majority of perpetrators are men. It's not that men are fundamentally worse than women. It's that we live in a culture which has promoted for thousands of years men's ownership of women. Like, it's, I'm sure if it was reversed, like, women would potentially feel quite possessive of men. But actually, and that understanding that abuse is instrumental, it is purposeful, and it is intended for the perpetrator to benefit from it. I think lots of Christians don't understand this because they sort of see him as a poor wounded man who's, you know, like, hurt people. Absolutely not. That's not what's going on. Hurt men, hurt women. It's not degendered, but actually this isn't about men's brokenness, and that if you give them enough counselling and enough like patting, that they'll suddenly become good partners. This is about them see the instrumentalness. It's about the benefits that comes from this, and actually we live in the Christian cultures we have perpetuate those narratives of benefits, where kind of male headship is offered, however that headship is kind of constructed, whether it's as like benevolent or another form, the reality is that sense of, and this is why complementarian churches can on a one-to-one level pastorally support women, but can't actually challenge abuse. And for those who aren't familiar with complementarianism as a term, the theology that men and women are complementary but different to the point where their roles are different from one another, that essentially when you start to get into this idea that men and women's roles are significantly different, in not in relation to biology, which obviously like some people can, you know, women have certain functions that men don't have, but when we then create meaning around that biology, that we, which means that men should be in charge and women should not, or that men can teach and women cannot, when we kind of, you know, that those things, while those communities can be communities which support women and can be safe for women, there is the inability to critique the wider structures and systems which underpin why those men think that they can be abusive, and potentially normalizes certain coercive behaviors that would be noticed much earlier in theology, in context where theology doesn't allow for men and women's difference in that way.
One of the things I'm really interested to hear your thoughts on is, you know, you mentioned when at the beginning when you were sharing your own story that you were incredibly young when you got sucked into this abusive relationship, 17. And you talked about how your own church upbringing hadn't remotely prepared you for the reality of relationships. It was all about don't do this, don't have sex before you're married, and that, and it was left at that. How can we do a better job of raising young people in the church? You know, let's imagine for the sake of argument that we're all evangelicals who agree with the kind of historic teaching that sex is in God's plan reserved for marriage. But how do we do a better job of preparing, particularly I'm thinking of Christian girls, teenage girls, that, you know, it's teaching the sound things about consent and about understanding red flags and where to find help and all that stuff, so we don't just reduce it to this kind of ethical question of make sure you don't have sex before you're married.
So here's Tim speaking as a father of a young girl.
Yeah, you're like, please help me out. Help me out. The end. I think one of the things is we have to accept the context we're in, that we're not, where I would say for young people, Gen Z, and apparently the next one's Gen A, like, are not existing in the same context that we did. And so we have to contextualize what we do within the context of youth culture, where the things that maybe were given for my generation are not a given anymore. It is not a given that the name you're going to have as a teenager will be the name your parents gave you. It is not a given that you will identify kind of in terms of gender or sexuality in ways that are in any way notions that millennials would have like strong like confidence or literacy in necessarily. You know, like none of my son is 18 and none of his friends are called the names their parents gave them. Like, we wouldn't be able to, like, around sexuality, like, we wouldn't know which young people coming through our door there might be sexual activity possibly around and which ones there wouldn't be, because like none of the kind of rules that applied 20, 30 years ago apply for young people in the particularity of their context. And so I think that this idea that we can just, like, there are things that we can communicate and there are ways that we can talk about this. But I think the first thing we do is have to commit ourselves to building literacy about the particularity and the location of young people's actual lives and what are they learning and what are they hearing and how do we then... how do we form our messaging and our communication in ways that is meaningful for them around the reality of being on TikTok, of being digital natives, around the, you know, the Andrew Tate kind of, like, not, I don't want to give him too much credit, but, you know, like that kind of the fact that there is a whole kind of anti-feminist movement for some young men, and the fact that pornography is where most young people are learning about sex, like that, and six is about the average kind of, like, is an age where a lot of young people, children, will have started to see pornography. Like, this idea that, you know, I think that parents and adults are often thinking that young people are blank slates onto which by the time they're like 14, 15, we need to like tell them something about sex. I'm like, this starts when they're like 3 and 4. It starts with, do we say to little girls about how pretty they are and how nice they look and are they being kind and are we being friendly? And are we saying that to the same to the boys? And are we saying to girls about how clever they are and how capable they are and what they can achieve? Are we modelling in our relationships with our spouse? Are we modelling healthy, positive conflict? So are we talking about the fact that conflict is a healthy part of a relationship? Are we critically giving them the ability to be critical consumers of media? Are we, when they watch Bluey, are we saying, oh, you know, Peppa Pig, Daddy Pig's not doing very many things in the house. What are we doing around creating conversations that, you know, my rule with my kids was always, if you don't want to talk about it, talk about it, which I'm sure they're overjoyed about. But I think that sense of we are our kids' primary educators, and that role that parents have that is often being farmed out to schools, often being farmed out to youth workers. Like, we as parents need to get to grips with the culture and context our young people are actually living in. And then we need to think about what messages within that are harmful, both from Christian theology, but also in the wider culture, and how do we equip our kids to have positive conversations, and fundamentally, how do we create a space and a family that is safe enough that our kids know they can tell us anything? And you know, so there are lots and lots of, you know, I've like written a course about how to do it. My book talks about how we can raise kids in a way that's positive and meaningful around some of this stuff, particularly raising boys, but also girls. But like, I would say the big problem that we have is that we are often trying to have these conversations with young people in a vacuum, as if they're not like existing in an entire culture or context, which is completely different than the one that even I as a mum who had my kid at 18, like, is completely different than the context I grew up with. And for people who are like not having their kids till their like 30s or 40s, like, I mean, there is a massive chasm in terms of the cultural notions and norms from somebody who has their kid at 30 to what their kid's going to grow up with. So building cultural literacy among young people and around young people's lives is I would say, the starting point.
As ever, the church is running about 20 to 30 years behind the times.
Yeah, and that's actually, in terms of the way that the internet like speeds up the narrative shifts and the narrative change, actually that's probably around 60 to 70 years, given that the internet can normalize things much more quickly. You know, what would have taken 10 years to become normal becomes normal in about, you know, 3 minutes. Do you know what I'm saying? So, like, when you've got an entire media, you know, TikTok, when kids are in this media 24/7, like, actually, the speed with which the cultural narrative shift is so much faster. So we are probably, parents are probably about what would have been 20 years behind is now 60 years behind, where their kids find themselves in terms of thinking, in terms of philosophical frameworks and all of that.
Yeah. Can I ask another, is that right, Jen? If I ask another question, this actually comes from my wife, Jess, who knew we were having this conversation today, and said, when she talks to a lot of her non-Christian friends, they often talk about the necessity for women, for partners or initiatives, to have what's often called like an escape fund, like a pot of money that they alone control that their partner can't access, so that if they ever need to bail, they're not kind of financially tied to the relationship. She would love to know your thoughts on that in a Christian context, where, you know, me and my wife have a shared joint bank account and there isn't any money that I don't also have access to. And as it happens, I'm more financially literate than she is, and so I manage all the bills and everything like that. She wouldn't even know how to get access to her money. I like to think that's an expression of trust in me, but, you know, is that unwise? Or do you think actually Christians, our idea of like trust and consolidation and you know, it's quite a lot of Christian couples do want to have shared bank accounts because they see it as part of like becoming one unit, one family. It's not my money, her money, it's our money. Yeah, I'd just love to know your thoughts on that in a Christian context. Is an escape fund still a wise option, even for people like my wife?
Well, I would say, like, it's a really interesting question. And I think it comes from the fact that most outside the kind of Christian context, most people are together a long time before they get married. Like, they often like come with two completely separate households that then come together into one household. And so that ability to move into like shared financial stewardship is not the same as for couples who start off like, you know, kind of Christianity. You still probably have a high proportion of people who move and get together after living at home with their parents, potentially, who, you know, you're probably finding less and less of that now, where people have probably had independent lives before they get married, because people don't get married till older. So I think some of that is about, like, it's quite difficult if you're getting, if you're in a long-term relationship with somebody, and marriage often is like a much further on in the relationship, you might have kids by that point. So I think that what's really interesting is that this, the way that we organize money in a context that is quite different to the one where two people start off at home and then basically their independent life starts together in a home that they've come to together. And then that there's almost natural points to organize your finances around that. Whereas I guess within like a context where that's not how you're coming together, you have two independent lives that join up. You probably like work out who's putting what pot money into the pot for the stuff. And so there's a sense of financial independence being maintained. I think probably the transience of relationships that actually most people are not starting off any relationship thinking it's going to be forever. And then it suddenly becomes the final relationship. Whereas I think Christians are kind of see like a life partnership as the goal of a relationship or kind of that's eventually there should be that one of these partnerships should lead to a lifelong partnership. So I think there is like a whole kind of cultural differences, isn't there, for those who aren't coming from that perspective at all, which I think means that the point at which you start talking about shared bank accounts and shared finance is complex, and financial abuse can operate in different ways. So somebody might expect their partner to have control of the finances in terms of that they pay the bills, they hold the bank account, that all of that. But actually their partner's spending all the money and getting them into debt. Like who actually has control of the finances isn't the person who pays the bills and has the bank account. It's the person who's spending all the money, right? So this idea that financial control comes from the person who holds the bank account or holds the, is not as simple as that. You know, financial control might be about stopping somebody working or it sabotaging their job, or it might be about signing them up for loans. There's all sorts of ways this can look. So I think it's really tricky because it's not as simple as that's always going to be the solution. The solution isn't always going to be to have, because actually if we have to share a separate account, it might be that he's not putting in his share. You know, for instance, once she then has children, if she takes any time off, very often what happens in a couple where they don't have, where their shared account isn't they also have their own money, is she then suddenly becomes much less financially afloat because she's now not working and he's keeping the same amount of money to himself. And so I think this idea that model is always going to be protective and a safeguard only works if you're regularly having conversations about finances, and when she then takes time off, if she does have a kid or if she gets sick or she has to look after elderly relatives, because to be honest, it's women who are often doing that stuff. Like actually, it's really interesting, the recent referendum in Ireland about the status of women, that what's really interesting is while it's really sexist in the constitution that essentially a woman's place is in the home, the purpose of that constitutional was a safeguard that women shouldn't have to have a job alongside caring for their family, because having a family should be a significant and serious role that should be taken seriously by the state. The problem is they never attached any money to that role, conveniently. So it becomes this kind of principle that actually isn't resourced in a way that's meaningful for women's lives. But what it means in Ireland is that if women become single parents in Ireland, they are not immediately pushed back into the workplace to have to get a job when their children are one or two. In the UK now, when your child turns two, you are expected to be working in a job landscape where you can't actually get a job that works around your child and that you can afford with childcare. So like, this sense that actually some of the things that you might say are quite misogynistic or sexist are actually safeguards for women that we don't have in countries where there isn't those sorts of writing into law. So I think we have to be really careful about the unintended consequences of removing things from law which actually can become safeguards for women in a context of a society which is in a state where everybody has to be a consumer and a producer, and actually where women's producing of babies and of care and of love are not considered like monetary value and so don't count. And so I think there is all sorts of, so I know that's not really an answer to the question, but what I would say is like I don't think there's a hard and fast rule to how do we have financially equitable and financially safe couple-based relationships. And I think the assumption that, well, if I've got an escape fund, that will be it. Actually, like I would be asking questions about what type of partner you have, if you feel you need to have an escape fund, and what that means about the reality of your relationship. And actually, I would be asking deeper questions about that being normalized as a healthy thing. I'm not saying it shouldn't be part of, for people who don't feel safe and for people who aren't able to admit that they don't feel safe. I think if that's a way that they're enabled to essentially be safer, regardless of their own construction of their lives, that's fine. But I would say there's no kind of hard and fast rules to this. And I think we, within Christian culture, we have to look at all the ways that sexism, misogyny in our culture is harmful, but I think there's lots of things that we have around respect and love and care and mutuality that actually we're losing in other parts of the society, and a sense of grace, like grace is being lost. And so I think that sense that actually we have to find ways to identify the things that are precious and valuable and not just throw out everything because it's not like the kind of secular society, when there's a lot in secular society that is absolutely atrocious and awful, and we can't just think, well, that's better than where we are. We're like, we're just in different places, and we need to value the things that are good and challenge the things that are not.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Can I just go slightly left field again, as you're here, because it's something that I'm really interested and troubled about, and that is that, again, out there in secular society, this idea of male coercive control is something that people by and large accept exists and is a problem and so on, except in this one area, which is abortion. So in the standard narrative that we hear in secular society is that coercive control, where men coerce women to have abortion, is incredibly rare. And in fact, reproductive coercion is usually the opposite. It's men coercing women to have to be pregnant and to remain pregnant, to have children. And in reports, you know, studies I've seen where people are asked, why did you have an abortion? They put pressure from a partner extremely low. And I just find very hard to accept that that's a reality.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting one, and it's something that I think is a neglected conversation by those who would articulate themselves as pro-choice. And I think, you know, within the Own My Life course, all of the material uses scenarios. We don't expect women to ever share any of their personal stuff. And one of those scenarios includes a woman who's been forced to have an abortion, because we try to make sure we cover the vast range of women's experiences and that we're explicitly talking about the things that are often not spoken about. And I think that, like, actually making sure we're explicit about this being a reality for women. And actually, like, the first, when I was accessing support for having been subject to abuse, the first group that I ever went to, the first session, a woman disclosed how her partner had forced her to abort twins and then never came back because it was so traumatic. And so I think that sense of understanding the place of coercion in women's lives in relation to reproduction. And actually, I think on the other side of it, those who are kind of pro-life and are committed to supporting women in that way often are not really aware that lots and lots of women don't have a choice about becoming pregnant. So about half of women who've had an abusive partner have been subject to reproductive coercion. And that might be pricking holes in condoms. It might be not letting them be on the pill, cutting the contraceptive implant out of their arm in more extreme cases. So, you know, like, that actually, I think that what you've got is, on both sides, you've got this kind of neglect of the fact that somebody can be coerced into pregnancy by those who are invested and are concerned about abortion. And then you've got those who are concerned about women being having to continue pregnancies when they are not able to or don't want to, neglecting the coercion that exists at the other side. You know, and we see this across any, you know, you look at the, like, sex industry, for instance, those who are, like, committed to sex worker rights, where I wouldn't even use the term sex worker because I don't think it's a legitimate term. But for those who think that like, sex work is work, they would neglect the number of women who are coerced and forced into the sex industry. And those on the side who are opposed to the sex industry and women working in there often remove or ignore the agency that women operate in and want to create women as these kind of perfect innocents, which is why trafficking is such an attractive kind of issue for Christians, because, you know, like, you've got perfect victims in trafficking, which you don't have in any other forms of men's violence. And so I think across all of these things, what we need to do from our location is say, what is the vulnerabilities and the weaknesses that we are not making time or space for around men's violence, and how do we make time and space for that, and how do we ensure that our arguments are fairly challenging the other side in the ways that they are not considering men's violence, usually in ways that are quite different to the ways we are. And so I think that I'd say is definitely a reality. And I think that the ability to talk about, you know, that actually for those on the kind of the very, like, advocacy side of the kind of pro-choice movement, this there is a complete neglect of the idea that for most women, it is a painful and difficult thing to have an abortion. Not for everybody, but actually kind of this shout your abortion stuff and that kind of stuff. Actually, it's not really meeting women in the lived reality of lives that usually, and none of this is simple, none of this is easy. And yes, for some people, they might want to celebrate that. I think there's lots of things about these narratives that, particularly in the place we find ourselves, like in this postmodern framework where it's all very consumeristic and very kind of social media, digital focused, a lot of the complexity gets is so reduced into these very simplistic messages. And unfortunately, simplistic messages rarely reflect the reality of people's lives.
Mm, yeah, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've hit an hour. we could keep on talking clearly for a long time because it's really fascinating hearing your thoughts on some of these really important questions, Natalie, but I fear we must probably draw our conversation to a close here. We'll have to have you back on another time because there's clearly lots of things we didn't talk about, but thank you so much for sharing your own story, your experience, your expertise, helping us think through some of these questions. And thank you everyone else for listening. We'd love to hear your feedback on what we've been talking about. So please do email in comments, questions, disagreements. The address, as always, is MOLAD, M-O-L-A-D, at premier.org.uk. I'm sure you could find out more, Natalie, on her website, which is?
Yeah, so the Own My Life course is ownmylifecourse.org, and my kind of more general website is nataliecollins.info. So just Google me, you'll find me somewhere.
Brilliant. And we do look up her book as well, Out of Control. I know that's been really influential in lots of people here in the UK and hopefully overseas as well. But thank you, Natalie, for your time. And thank you for listening, everyone. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.